Good morning, everyone. I will call the meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We have a quorum. The first order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Engen, have you looked over the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have looked at the minutes and motion for their approval.
All right. Any discussion? All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. The first bill on our docket today is Majority Leader Niska's bill. We have two fascinating Bar Association bills today. And so I hope you all had your caffeine this morning. And so we will hear the Niska bill first. I will move House File 360, which is before the committee.
747.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. It's 747. Sounds like the number for an airplane or something. Representative Niska. One more thing. I recommend that it be passed and re-referred or placed on the general register. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for welcoming me again. Representative Feist, thank you for co-sponsoring this bill as well. As you mentioned, this is a bill that comes from the State Bar Association. It's just updating the Business Corporations Act in order to keep Minnesota as up-to-date as possible with best practices and developing norms in corporate governance. It was carefully designed through a long Bar Association process within the corporate law section or business law section that included careful study of recent changes in the Model Business Corporations Act as well as developments in Delaware, the leading jurisdiction for corporate law. So passing this bill will help to ensure that Minnesota remains an attractive place to incorporate. As you probably know, whether a business incorporates in Minnesota or not is different from whether it does business in Minnesota or not. And so there's a reason for Minnesota to continue to be competitive as a good place to incorporate. I do have with me today Attorney Kim Lowe on behalf of the Bar Association, who will be able to provide more information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kim Lowe. I'm a local practitioner here in the Twin Cities. I'm a business law practitioner, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Section. You'll see me later today for another reason, but I was a member of the committee that worked on these changes, and I've worked on these changes over the years. Like Representative Niska said, we spend a lot of time I gotta take my cheaters on and off. We spend a lot of time looking at what's happening around the country and other states and what's happening nationally when we think about our business law statutes. What's important to remember is these statutes, these acts, cover the internal affairs of a business, not the external affairs. This is how the shareholders and the officers and the directors interact with each other. So keep that in mind. A lot of people think, oh, this is keeping a business from being how it's interacting with the public. No, that's a different set of laws. This is really how these businesses deal with each other, how the shareholders and owners of these businesses deal with each other, which is important because some of the things, the changes that we're making, really talk to who has a right to get records, how do we fix problems, what do we do, how does a business function if there's an emergency and they have to call a shareholder meeting and have to do something like that. So the changes are listed in a small a handout we gave you, one page. They're a little long if you look at the document itself, so I won't bore you and read it line by line, but I will give you the highlights on what we're proposing. One of the biggest changes is we're creating a concept called emergency powers. Now, this concept is not an emergency powers like the government. This is a concept that allows an organization, a company, in the event there is an emergency, to still act and do business. So they can do it in one or two ways. They can have amended their bylaws to allow for this, thinking ahead, like what do we do if we have an emergency? How do we call a meeting? How do shareholders meet if there's an emergency? So they can either amend their bylaws, or if a company hasn't amended their bylaws, then we have added a provision that says if there's an emergency, this is how shareholders or directors can meet and do business. And so that was added to our statute. It's been added to most of this around the country. This is percolating around because of the results of what happened during the pandemic. Ours is slightly tweaked, like we do in Minnesota. We never do anything completely like every other state, and it's slightly tweaked to allow the boards of directors in the event of emergency to determine if there is not or the end of an emergency. That's what's in ours right now. That's what we're proposing to add. The other items that we're adding, I think that might be of interest to this group, is we're adding an option for defective acts. And we don't have that right now in Minnesota. And it's a deterrent because what this allows us to do is, in the event something happens, typically the example is, When we form corporations, we have to authorize the number of shares. Usually we authorize 100,000 or a million or what have you. That number of shares dictates how many numbers of shares can be issued and sold to people. A lot of times what happens is companies are formed 20, 50 years ago and they've authorized 100 shares or 1,000 shares. Families are ticking along, mom, dad, kids, what have you. And they wake up one day and like, oh, our document says we have 1,000 shares, but we've actually spread amongst mom, dad, son, 200,000 shares. Well, right now we have no way to fix that. That's an oops that isn't really have any harm to it. But by adding this provision to our act, it allows us to fix those defective, it's called a defective act, with a mechanism, full disclosure, clarity, but we don't have that now. So that's what this allows us to do, the corrections to the defective acts. We've also given a little bit of more transparency or options to get information to beneficial owners. A lot of times people own the shares of their company in a trust. And that trust is not clear who has a right. If that trust, who has the right to get that information if the shares are held in a trust? And that's what we've been working on with that beneficial owner clarification. The rest of the changes are all somewhat boring, to say it mildly. If you have any questions about them or have any ideas that you want to ask me about, please feel free to do so.
Thank you for your testimony. Lead Liebling, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. That was good presentation and explained a lot of this. As I read through the language, most of it did make a lot of sense to me, but one part I'm a little concern about, would just like an explanation, is the very end of the bill. So section 21 of the bill, there are a couple of paragraphs here that have to do with additional remedies shareholder representatives, and this is, I think, about the merger or exchange. And so on the very last page, starting at line 22.1, a plan of merger or exchange may provide, and then going down to this paragraph starting at 22.1, for the appointment, these are really hard paragraphs to read, right, because this language is extremely convoluted, but I'll just kind of read it in a way that I think simplifies it also. It allows for the appointment of somebody as a representative of the shareholders who have rights to purchase of the corporation, including shareholders whose rights to purchase must be canceled in the merger or exchange. And it allows for the delegation to a person with the sole and exclusive authority to take action or bring claims on behalf of those people, and that this appointment is irrevocable. So it sounds like we're giving the corporation the right to appoint somebody to represent people who may not want to be represented, you know, appoint somebody that the corporation wants to appoint to represent people irrevocably. What am I missing here? If you could just explain what's happening and why you need this paragraph, that would be great.
Ms. Lowe?
Chair Scott. So you're right, this is a very dense paragraph. This law comes from Delaware, and if you know anything about Delaware, they write in like no punctuation and dense paragraphs. So I applaud you for even digging into it. So really what this does is it creates a remedy, which we don't have now. And the language is very thick, but that remedy really says that when a plan of merger or exchange is approved, remember these are approved by the shareholders themselves, they do have an opportunity to review them and approve them, they can appoint a representative to speak for them. And that appointment of the representative is what I think the language is that you're looking at, Representative Liebling. And that's what this does. It really just allows for that representative to be there in the event that there is some litigation, a challenge, what have you, that representative itself speaks for the shareholders.
Lead Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so that gives me a little concern. I'm no way an expert on corporate law. This is like the one class I never took in law school. But it sounds to me like what it's doing is allowing the corporation in this merger process to take rights away, because it includes people whose shares or rights to purchase are canceled in the merger. So isn't it saying that some people who might be dissenters to what's going on are that the corporation is being allowed to appoint somebody to represent them and then always speak for them, even though they are dissenters to the process?
Ms. Lowe.
Thank you, Chair. No, that's really not what it does. This is really a housekeeping matter that we don't have right now. Right now, if we didn't have something like this, when something arises, the shareholders, even with canceled shares, don't have a right to go back and speak. This happens in advance of something and allows the representative to be appointed in advance in part of the plan of merger. So there's no bait and switch here. There's nobody losing rights. It's really a housekeeping matter that would allow for that appointment in advance. Because a lot of times they're disparate. They're gone at this point. They've been bought out. They don't have any rights. So what this does is it gives that right in the beginning as part of the plan of merger. When we do an acquisition, a merger, what have you, the shareholders approve the whole plan. They have it in front of them. They have a right to look at it. And by not doing this, what we're doing is leaving these groups without anybody because there's no way to get them back together again. And we don't want them all speaking for themselves. That doesn't make any sense. They all have equal rights.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I'm not going to go on with this too long, but as I read the language, it says, for the appointment at or after the time at which the plan of merger or exchange is approved. So this is either as it's being approved or after it's being approved that they can appoint this person to represent these people whose rights are going to be hurt or could be hurt. I don't know. That just gives me a little concern. And honestly, the idea that we're just lifting language from another state doesn't give me a lot of comfort, and especially when we all acknowledge, I think, that maybe it could be written a little better and a little more clearly, but I just don't want us as a committee here, because, you know, just to say to the members, I mean, you all know, we're the only place this is going to get vetted, because when this gets to the House floor, nobody's going to probably ask a single question, nor should they, because obviously, you know, we have the expert here now. None of us are experts on this. We really, so this committee has to vet this. And I just don't want to take away some minority shareholders' rights without meaning to in this. I mean, maybe this, you know, maybe we need a clarifying amendment if the language isn't saying what I think it's saying. I don't know. I'd love to hear what other members think about it.
Majority Leader Niska, you had a comment, yeah, and then we'll go to Ms. Lowe.
Yeah, I wanted to give some additional context that I think you actually have it. If you understand the context of a merger agreement and the potential of a broken merger and the complete loss of any rights by the shareholder and the target company in that context, this actually is creating a mechanism for enforcement of rights by the target company's shareholders that isn't clearly present right now. So this is creating a mechanism, again, a mechanism that is contractually agreed to on the front end, but it's creating the way for those shareholders to actually have some enforceable rights that they would not have as clearly under the status quo without this language. So it's not taking away any rights that currently exist. It's trying to create a mechanism for enforcement of rights. Again, we're talking about the shareholders of the target company. So if a target company is being bought in a merger and then the merger is busted, they have lost something now as a result of that merger not going through, not closing. And so this is actually creating rights or creating an enforcement mechanism to them that isn't clearly there and under the status quo.
Ms. Lowe, anything to add?
Yes, thank you, Chair. To your point, we have a robust group of lawyers and people who know how we do this will chuckle, who represent minority shareholders in the state of Minnesota vehemently, zealously. They have looked at all this language and found no concerns at all and no disenfranchisement, no removal of rights or anything that looks frightening to them. And we went through this language line by line with that group as well. Some of the changes that we are proposing did not make it because of that group. So this is not one of them, and it's never been raised by any lawyers who work with or represent minority shareholders.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Liebling's follow-up kind of addressed the issues that I was going to address, but I just I'm grateful to hear that those folks did have a chance to review. I did read this bill. I'm not a lawyer. I do find my Nothing sends my red flags off more than lawyers talking to each other about how confusing language is and all, you know, everyone reviewed it. Don't worry about it, right? Like, this is corporate law. I don't trust corporations or their lawyers, you know? So I appreciate the opportunity here for people to kind of like really get into it. But my specific question was answered. So thank you very much.
And I will renew my motion that House File 747 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will have Vice Chair Hudson take over while I go to the table for my bill presentation.
We have House File 360 for consideration in our committee. Chair Scott, would you like to move that House File 360 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very well. We have the bill before us. Chair Scott, would you like to offer your A2 amendment to House File 360?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment makes some technical changes that the Bar Association realized needed to be made after the drafting of the original language.
Thank you. And I believe it's designated A1 just for clarification. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment, and is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. All right. Chair Scott, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a revision to some changes to the Minnesota Trust Code. And about 10 years ago, the Trust Code underwent a major overhaul in the state of Minnesota. The Bar Association has monitored issues that have arisen since that new code was adopted. And the Bar Association spent years developing this legislation, which is intended to clarify and streamline provisions in the Trust Code. In addition, the bill closes a loophole related to the ability of an estranged parent to inherit from a deceased child. And with me today is Attorney Lauren Barron, who can explain more, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just try to hit on a few highlights of the changes. It is a longer bill and, again, came from many years of study by practitioners in the field, hearing feedback from Minnesotans who are trying to get relief through the application of these laws, and then also several court cases that have interpreted the trust code since then, and every single amendment goes in line with those court decisions. So I'll point out that in Section 5, we've raised the value of terminating an uneconomic trust from $50,000 to $150,000. This would mean that individuals don't have to go to court for a trust under $150,000 to get it terminated and distributed to the beneficiaries. In Section 1 of the bill, that talks about extending the term of a trust, this is something that at least 37 states, I believe, have done so far, where trusts do have a maximum duration period. It's approximately 90 years. Many states have either eliminated this rule completely or have extended it somewhere in the range of 360 to 1,000 years. Minnesota settled on 500 years as a kind of a middle ground and a move that has been pretty typical in trust law. The directed trusts, sections 10 through 17 of the bill address something called directed trusts, which in a trust, essentially you have a fiduciary relationship. You have a trustee who's a fiduciary holding assets for the benefit of the beneficiary. The fiduciary typically does things like investments and distribution decisions, and those can be bifurcated among different individuals or other parties who would hold those separate powers. It creates a relationship, and our statute lays out how that relationship works, and the changes here are meant to just streamline and better clarify how those relationships and those parties are supposed to act with respect to each other and what powers they have. Section 9 of the bill establishes a rule about accepting a trusteeship. So currently, Minnesota law says that when a trustee is appointed, they have a reasonable time to accept. For sake of clarity, we have introduced 120 days to allow a person who knows about their appointment to have that amount of time to accept the trusteeship. Sections 20 through 28 address something called the trust decanting. This is a method by which a trustee is already vested with a power to be able to make certain changes to a trust agreement, essentially create a new trust agreement and move assets from the old trust to the new trust. It is something that's just inherent in the power of a trustee. We do have a statutory framework that was adopted for this about 10 years ago, and in order to kind of answer some questions and streamline the procedural aspect of that, this bill makes several updates to that section of the code. Section 4 of the bill, now I'm going to talk about a few amendments where the court interpreted the trust code. Section 4 of the bill clarifies that when a trust is created, it does not need to have the same formalities as a will, and that is a specific difference that a will has to have two witnesses and to be present in the presence of the testator and hear and see him. And a trust does not have those same formalities. In fact, it can be created orally. You can give something to somebody to hold in trust for the benefit of another person simply by speaking that into existence. And so there was some question about the formalities of a trust that were decided in a court case, and then this amendment clarifies and goes with the court decision on that. Section 5 of the bill, and I believe Section 7, address the ability to use a power of attorney to amend a trust or to terminate a trust. There are some questions about whether our statutory power of attorney can be used to amend a trust agreement when the person who created the trust, if they've also created a power of attorney, or that the agent can then go and amend that trust or terminate that trust. There was a court decision by the Court of Appeals in Minnesota about how that can be used, and so this law is meant to clarify what the court decision was in that case. Let's see, Section 30 of the bill addresses a case that was decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2023 on whether or not a divorce of a couple would terminate the ability to inherit of people related to the ex-spouse. So most people expect that when they get divorced, if they've created a will or done a beneficiary designation, and our law does provide, the ex-spouse is excluded from inheriting from the deceased person. But if you've included a term in your will that says something like, and if that person isn't alive, then give it to the heirs of that person or give it to the children of that person who are unrelated to the deceased person, then most people would also assume that the heirs of their ex-spouse are excluded, but that wasn't entirely clear, so the Minnesota Supreme Court decided that that is the law, and then this amendment would clarify that as well in the statute. And finally, I'll talk about Section 29 of the bill. This is what Representative Scott talked about as the closing the loophole on an estranged parent's ability to inherit from a deceased child. The law currently provides that a child under the age 18, if they have an estranged parent, somebody who's not paying child support, something like that, if the child dies, then that estranged parent is not entitled to inherit from the deceased child. Once the person turns 18, if they were to die the day later, that parent could inherit from that person under our current law. And so this is meant to extend for, you know, like parties similarly situated, but for the age of the person who died, that the relationship of that same child would not cause their parent to be able to inherit after they've reached age 18. I'll stop there to see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Barron. Personally, I'm a little curious about the extension of the term of the trust from 90 years to 500.
Yep.
Can you walk me through, first of all, how we got to the 90 and what the rationale is for extending it?
Yeah. So Minnesota has something called the rule against perpetuities. This is a lawyer term that most people don't engage with at any point in their lives, but essentially it means that when you've created a property interest where you've given property to another person to hold for the benefit of another, then that can only extend for a certain amount of time. before it needs to be collapsed into a single property holder. And that's what we call the rule against perpetuities. The actual rule is that that can extend for a life in being plus 21 years. Get into how that's applied. But there is sort of a presumption that it's about 90 years. And our law also provides that if we can't decide how the life and being plus 21 years works, then we just say 90. And if your trust extends beyond 90, then we're going to make you collapse it, terminate it, and distribute it to the beneficiaries. There has been a movement among states to extend that term to allow people to create trust that would, you know, as people live longer, essentially be available to their great-grandchildren or further generations. And as a matter of staying competitive in trust law and attracting people to this state to form trusts in this state, it is a common aspect that people look at and where they're going to form their trusts. And Minnesota does lose a lot of business to states like South Dakota and Florida and some of these states that have extended their trust term. I would say that in my experience, it's a little bit of a distinction without a difference, because you get to a point where a trust is so small that it's going to terminate of its own weight anyway. So is there a very practical difference between a 360-year trust or a 500-year trust? I don't know any trusts that are out there that are now terminating because they've hit 360 years. You know, it's unlikely that any trust will extend really that far. It's more just the acknowledgement that a trust could extend that far, that becomes an aspect that people look at to determine whether the jurisdiction is favorable to create trusts and bring business to the state.
That is fascinating. Thank you. Is there any other any other member discussion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask a very similar question, so I'm super glad that you did focus on that. And you know, I'd like to push on it just a little bit more, and I do understand what the rule against perpetuities is, so I do have a little advantage there, maybe. But so I think there's more to this than, you know, I am really glad that the chair asked the question. My understanding of, say, the rule against perpetuities, kind of the underlying rule here, the underlying idea, mm-hmm. is that it's not good for society to lock up assets for too long. Mm-hmm. So it seems like, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when you say that a trust can go on for 500 years, you're essentially locking up control of assets for 500 years. And maybe I'm wrong in remembering what the rule of perpetuities was about, but I thought it was the idea that, you know, we're not a monarchy. We don't have castes in our society like British nobility. We don't have landowners that are, you know, hand down property for generation after generation. And that this is kind of what this is doing, isn't it? When we allow trusts to go on for just basically an unlimited amount of time. I mean, right, 500 years, 360 years, none of us are going to be around, and who knows what the world would be like. Mm-hmm. But it's just the idea that we're kind of authorizing people to lock up property for a very long period of time. Isn't that kind of where what that is doing, or am I off base somehow?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. The rule against alienation essentially takes the teeth out of your concern there. And the rule against alienation says that for that shorter duration of time, that's all that the property can be held in trust before it needs to be sold. And so a person cannot actually continue to hold the same property in trust for a longer duration than that initial common law rule against perpetuity is what you're thinking of, the life and being plus 21 years. And so if you had, you know, I agree with you. I think that the underlying concern comes from estates, you know, if you think of Downton Abbey, right, holding the same property in trust for multiple generations. That still, in our system and under Minnesota law, that could not happen because that specific estate, that real property, would need to be sold by that time. You can't hold the same property in trust. And that's what the rule against alienation, which is part of that same section of the Minnesota Code, addresses.
Mr. Chair.
Lead Liebig.
Thank you for that answer. So that kind of brings me to the question then of why is it a competitive advantage to have a 500-year mm-hmm. term? Why does anybody care if it's, I mean, you kind of addressed this and said maybe they really don't. So I'm kind of wondering then why should we allow it under our law?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Barron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason to allow it is essentially because trust companies across the country are setting up their shops in jurisdictions where this is one of 5 or 10 factors that's considered, and a lot of trust business is leaving the state because of it. It is, from a fundamental standpoint, important because you can create a trust that would continue that long. You just can't keep the same property in trust. So it would be possible to create this relationship. Maybe you own a company and you're trying to do legacy planning for your company and you're trying to decide, you know, who are going to be the fiduciaries to continue running this company, you know, after the owner who has built this company has died. To cut that off after 90 years can be very limiting and very disruptive to the management of that company. But you would be able to continue potentially that in trust for a longer duration. These are considerations that people take into account when they create these vehicles for property ownership.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a different question if you'll indulge me. I don't know if other people are on the list. Okay. So thank you. Thank you for that answer. It doesn't sound as bad as it might be. I appreciate the part about the rule against perpetuity still being in effect. I have a different question, though. Section 13 of the bill talks about this powers of trust protector. Mm. And I have to say, I haven't thought about anything trust-related for a really long time, but I don't know what a trust protector really is and what it does. And it looks like you're taking away, in the bill, it's taking away some powers from this trust protector. So could you talk about that a little bit, explain what that person's function actually is and why you're making this particular change?
Ms. Barron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did gloss over a little bit the entirety of a directed trust. So this gets back to that idea that you have a fiduciary who can do things like investments, make investment decisions, make distribution decisions. There are a smattering of other administrative types of decisions, things like, is the trust going to be situs in Minnesota or Wisconsin? Is it going, what is the replacement mechanism for appointing a successor trustee? Typically more administrative related roles. The third position is typically something called a trust protector that does more administrative things. In our statute before, the way it was originally drafted, it sort of borrowed some of the, in particular, distribution decisions and put them in that laundry list of things that the trust protector is entitled to do. When someone is drafting a trust, they don't need to grant all the powers of a trust protector. Typically, you pick and choose, and typically it is a more administrative role. This was meant to clarify that if you have somebody exercising some sort of distribution decision, so approving a distribution, or in this case, I think one of the line items that was taken out was vetoing a distribution, that those would be considered under the purview of a distribution trust advisor. It is important because something we were trying to clarify in a step toward uniform law that we were taking in this revision is to make sure that you do have fiduciaries serving in roles at all time. So no matter what you call your investment trust advisor, no matter what you call your distribution trust advisor, if you have a person who's exercising those powers, they're going to be considered a fiduciary. And that was a clarification we were trying to make. And so we were trying to make sure that we consolidated distribution powers under the distribution trust advisor and didn't let those sit under a trust protector position, which, because it's administrative, sometimes is fiduciary and sometimes is not. That makes sense, that third role.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lee Liebling. Is there any other member discussion? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about page 22, line 22.18, the definition of estrangement. I understand that, you know, the passage of wealth
up is not the most common scenario where people are inheriting wealth. So this is already like a relatively narrow mm-hmm. category of people. That said, I feel like when you're under 18, the identification of estrangement is much more of a legal, practical, easily identifiable state of being. I feel like the relationships people have with their families vary widely, and like enmity, hostility, and indifference. I'm just thinking about like the era when my kids were like babies, and I was just like, all I care about is like this baby and my like nuclear family unit. And you know, other generations were like sidelined. So I'm just curious, like, do these terms have like common law definitions already? Like, do we know what enmity, hostility, and indifference mean under state law already?
Ms. Barron.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and it's something that the drafting committee on this really wrestled with, because you do have more of a definitive way of looking at what's estrangement for a minor when they're not providing material support. When you get beyond that, it's a little bit more difficult. So first, I would say that the drafting committee pointed to clear and convincing evidence. So at first, I just want to point out that the default rule is that any parent will inherit. This would be a circumstance where somebody felt they could present evidence to the court. So maybe it's, you know, spouse one or parent one and parent two, and you have parent one knows very well that parent two never showed up for anything, right? And so they want to go to court and they want to say, here's all the evidence of how parent two never showed up for anything. Also, they had this altercation and the police were called. You know, you'd have to present clear and convincing evidence that there was some hostility, estrangement, whatever. There are two parts to it as well. So the first part to it would be clear and convincing evidence of essentially the same standards that applied when the child was under 18. And so that's where we're looking at that the parental rights could have been terminated the way they treated that child. And so that's meant to continue the protection of the child who, you know, was not being cared for by that same parent. The second part of that, what you could prove, so if maybe under 18 you can prove that parental rights could have been terminated, that estranged definition of estranged, I am sorry that I'm not pulling from my mind where in Minnesota law it is, but that is drawn out of potentially the Parentage Act. I can't remember where this definition is otherwise in Minnesota law, but we were careful to marry it with a current definition of estranged that also that is defined exactly the same way. And so you would have some body of law to draw on to say what those terms mean for purposes of demonstrating it.
Representative Feist, do you have a follow-up? Thank you. Is there any other member discussion? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Scott renews her motion that House File 360, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails.
And then is that just, do you have, that should work now. It just usually needs to reset.
Members, just for clarification, the Uniform Law Commission and the judges, District Judges Association, they're in the same folder if you're looking for their presentations. So. Where is it? Y'all ready over there at the table?
It's not very often that we're nervous.
Oh, there's no need to be nervous. We are a kind and gentle bunch. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself for the tape and then go ahead with your presentation.
All right. May it please the chair and members of the committee. My name is Judge Mary Mahler. I am a judge in St. Cloud, Stearns County. I was appointed to the bench 15 years ago by past Governor Tim Pawlenty, and I practice civil litigation, so I have thoroughly enjoyed the discussion this morning. This is my colleague, Judge Richard Kyle. He has been on the bench for 10 years. He was appointed by past Governor Dayton. He is actually second generation to the judiciary, and he's also a past Minnesota State Bar Association president. And so I first of all want to thank you all for inviting us here. We kind of scrambled this weekend, and so hopefully things will go smoothly for us. I'm here to speak to you on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. I am the current president, and Judge Kyle is the chair of that organization. We are a trade organization that comprises over 300 district court judges across the state of Minnesota. We also include almost every trial court judge, the majority of the Court of Appeals, and several members of our Minnesota Supreme Court. Not always do the judges' goals and priorities align with state court administration. And so we were formed decades ago, I think it was in the 1940s, and we have tried to advocate for the needs of the judges, as well as to collaborate with other court staff, attracting and retaining high-quality workforce, as well as improving the court's, what I believe, exemplary delivery of accessible justice. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about the overview of MDJA and its four legislative priorities during this session. As an overview, before I go there, I just want to note through the key point of contact, who many of you likely know, is Nancy Haas. She is our attorney and lobbyist, and she represents MDJA at the Capitol. We've had a partnership with Ms. Haas and her firm that dates back over 35 years, and she's always an excellent resource to the legislature and in particular to this committee. So let me talk a little bit about MDJA's mission. As you can see on the slides, we are a professional organization. Some people ask, what's the difference between a senior judge and a retired judge? Senior judges are those that are still active in helping to cover calendars where a retired judge is fully retired. And so part of our goal, and it's our mission statement in our bylaws, is to promote the common professional interests of the judges, improve administration of justice in Minnesota, coordinate with government as well as you, the members of our legislative, regarding activities that are important to judges, and work to improve the administration of justice by maintaining high standards. So let's talk a little bit about our legislative work. We come to these hearings, and we appreciate the time that you are giving us to advocate for things that are important to the judges. And some of those things include fair judicial elections, court security, judicial security, pensions and benefits, access to judges or justice by members of our public, and other new initiatives. And usually we are in step with state court administration. A couple years ago, we were not. We felt that our law clerks really needed a substantial increase, and that was passed, and for that, we thank all of you. I was a direct beneficiary of that because I still have the same law clerk I've had for about 2.5 years, and she is excellent. So that's some of the work that we do that is distinct from state court. What other activities we do beyond legislation is working with our Judicial Board of Conduct to make sure that we are having high ethical standards, making sure that stakeholders have efficient and well-run open forums to those in the community. And then we also coordinate with, for example, the Minnesota State Bar Association. I saw our past president associating with their lobbyist earlier, Judicial Council, as well as the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and the county attorneys, as well as the public defenders. And so we work with those stakeholders to try and be on the same page when we come before you. Some of our other activities include talking about the Board of Judicial Standards and judicial canons, whether or not applicants for judicial positions vacated have to comply with the same code when they are running elections. There are significant restrictions on what we can and cannot do during elections. And perhaps the most important thing from my perspective is we also update on an annual basis the Minnesota civil jury instructions and the criminal jury instructions. And I know several of you members of this committee are actively practicing law or did, and you can understand what an invaluable resource those jury instructions are. And this is all things that we do through a group of individuals who donate their time after our regular jobs from 8 o'clock in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. So what I'd like to do now is turn to the four legislative priorities that are on MDJA's agenda. The first is judicial branch compensation, and it's always hard to come before people and ask for money. But if we don't, who will? And so we are in lockstep with state court administration this year. We fully support their request, and it is a compensation across the entire branch. So a lot of times people say, well, what do judges make? And we're not trying to hide the ball. We'll show you. Currently, we have our annual increases that go into effect July 1st. And the current salary, as you can see for the trial courts now in the bottom left, is $190,000 per year. Now, some of the things that we also have is we have an 11% contribution to our pensions. We have mandatory contributions to healthcare savings accounts and things of that nature. And so it looks like a big number, but then when you start taking out deductions and taxes, especially for young families who are paying daycare and things of that nature, we believe that is a reasonable salary where we are at economically. Why do we think that? We look at this next slide, which is the judicial salary tracking. And yes, we thank you for the increases that we've received, but I am also a product of 6 years from 2007 until about 2013 where judges received zero compensation increase, and that was because we were in a recession and we wanted to work with the legislature and the governor, and we recognized that. But the judges during that time frame fell woefully behind a national average, and that's what we're just trying to do, is to maintain our average. When you look at this salary comparison, it's a little hard to read, so I would encourage you, if you look at the solid lines, and you can see where the judicial compensation, we were in the 25th percentile, the green is the judges, and then where you are in the 75th percentile on the far right. And then when you compare that with others in different sectors, so the yellow or orangish colored, we're dealing with 2024 figures where lawyers with over 10 years of experience have a salary that is closer to $210,000 to $220,000. And if you want to go into general counsel, you can see that solid blue line has exponentially increased, where general counsel are receiving approximately $270,000 per year. And it's not infrequent where I am getting requests for legal fees where attorneys are charging $400, $500, $800 an hour, especially when we're dealing with that corporate-type litigation in the private sector. And so part of what we are looking at is we need to have a salary commensurate to attract attorneys and recruit the best, brightest, and most qualified attorneys. And then also we want to retain judges so that way we can benefit from their wisdom, their experience, and all of the training that we've invested into them. I will tell you, we are working with an economist we'll bring up a little later. His name is Dr. King Banyan. Maybe some of you recognize him. And he is providing a report, hopefully, for the Compensation Council, which is one of our agendas. And Dr. Banyan's numbers thus far are in lockstep with our request with state court administration. Some of the other work he and a graduate student are doing is also looking at why judges are leaving the bench early. They're interviewing six judges who retired before age 62. Our age of retirement is 65 without a penalty, mandatory retirement by age 70, and we have judges leaving the bench just because of the demands of the job and the amount of compensation. We have a judge who left the bench in Anoka and went back to work for the Anoka County Attorney's Office in a supervisory capacity because she could earn more money, frankly. So that's what we are looking at to try and maintain our judiciary. The next legislative priority is our pension funding. And I don't know how many of you know about this, but there has been a baseline budget for a $6 million contribution to the retirement fund. For those of you who are not aware or who are new to this committee, our pension was not pre-funded until 1992. And so over a decade ago, there was an amendment that was put into the base budget for that infusion of cash to shore up the judge's pension. But what did the judges give up in exchange for that? Well, we had senior judges and retired judges who were willing to take a decrease in a what I'll commonly refer to as a COLA type of a retirement issue. That went down to only 2%. And then for judges, we have a percentage when we are determining our pension, we lowered that calculator from 3.2% per year down to a 2.5% per year. And so we tried to decrease the money going out of the pension so we could shore up. And we are still have in safeguard once we get to, and I don't know the number, but you can reach out to me afterwards, once we get to the pension being 75% funded, not fully funded, but 75%, it's anticipated that automatic infusion would then be discontinued. And so those are the first two money legislative issues that we are asking you to support. The third and the fourth priorities, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Vice President Judge Kyle, and these are more policy topics.
Thank you, Judge Mahler and Madam Chair. It's good to be, I was a state bar president just before I was appointed 10 years ago, so I saw we have two MSBA-supported bills this morning. It was good that they're still here. I did take a property law class, so the rule of perpetuities, though, did get them over my head a little bit. So thank you for inviting us and giving us this opportunity. I'm going to address the next two legislative priorities that the district judges have this session.
Can I stop you there for a moment? Could you please introduce yourself for a tape, then go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. My name is Richard Kyle. I'm a district court judge in the 2nd District, Ramsey County, so I didn't have as far to come this morning as Judge Mahler from Stearns County. And thank you again for the opportunity. Last session, this committee passed an important and joint judicial branch and MDGA priority to improve judicial safety by adopting the Judicial Court Staff Safety and Privacy Act. It was a judges and district judicial branch staff comprehensive approach to allowing the privacy of judges and judicial branch staff to be covered up basically from the internet. And there we are currently, that is an implementation phase right now. It was effective August 1. It sought to improve the judicial safety by ending the dissemination of internet access to judicial officers' personal information. That would include judicial private data. It would be determined to be or classified as private data. And this was an important thing to protect judges and their staffs and the judicial branch. And we appreciated the House and Senate for passing that act last year. As a result, though, there were still some key stakeholders who were asking for more for a real estate exception. There were concerns raised by both the Minnesota State Bar Association, Real Estate Property Division, and county recorders about how to address lack of access on the internet to the judges' private data, such as real estate records. You know, they'd have to come to the county court
they have to come to the county recorder to get that information. That has been working. They've been working on the fix. There's been a work group working together to come together this session to basically make a fix on this real estate issue. A draft bill is going to be ready relatively soon. I'm told it is. I don't know if it's Jacketed, is that their name? I think Jacketed, yep, and Nancy gave me the thumbs up. So it'll be coming forward. We're hoping this will be a fix that will be satisfied. And just giving an example, the county recorders were concerned that all these people would be coming down, they'd be asking for property searches, and it would be a real burden on their staffs. We're basically, the new bill that's being proposed would shift the burden to the judge or the judicial employee to come down, essentially with all the data, so that doing all that research and identifying exactly what it is that they want to have redacted or covered up, essentially doing all that research instead of the county recorders and their staffs. And we believe we've got a fix, and we're optimistic that the bill will be before the House and Senate shortly. These judicial safety incidents are increasing. It's vital that it gets passed. Just in the last few weeks, I've learned of two new incidents that I was not even aware of. One from Crow Wing County. There was a judge there. I won't mention her name. She had been presiding over a family matter, family court matter. The litigants were disgruntled. They were not happy with some of her decisions, and they began harassing this judge. Harassing this judge to the point where the judge had to get a harassment restraining order. The litigants immediately violated that order by going to her home. They were prosecuted by a Crow Wing County attorney who later became a judge, so at least he knew what he was getting into when he applied for the job. They were prosecuted, and that now colleague county attorney was just amazed at how easy it was to get judicial information in the public and how easy it was for these people to find the personal information from that judge. Just last week at our board meeting, we learned of a judge in Douglas County who woke up at 2 a.m. to find a drone outside her home and outside the front door within 100 feet of the house tracking them.
10 feet of her door.
Oh, okay. 10 feet. 10 feet. So yeah. These are issues. These are real. In the past year, myself, I received a letter threatening to file a, I don't know if it was a $5 billion or a $50 billion lien on my house. I don't think it makes any difference. It was from a person I had issued a warrant for failing to appear at a court appearance. I didn't know who this person was, but he knew who I was. He knew the name of my spouse. He knew our address. He had the complete property description, and no lien has been filed. As far as I'm aware, the Attorney General's office is monitoring. But this is the kind of things that I wasn't so worried about the lien. I was worried about the fact that he knows exactly where I live and was brazen enough to send the letter to me after I'd issued a warrant for his arrest and his return address was on the letter. These are the things that we are seeing increasingly. So thank you again for the bill last year. We hope that we can have a real estate fix this year. Our fourth and last legislative priority is our modifications to the Compensation Council statute. Representative Jim Nash will be the chief author of this legislation in the House. The timing of the report, that's a big issue right now. The timing of the report, we believe, will result in recommendations being made for more useful information to all in advance of the legislature, in advance of any action taken by the legislature. Right now, that Compensation Council issues their report April 1. Well, you know where you are in the budget process on April 1. A lot of decisions have already been made. It's too late in the game to get information about compensation recommendations about judges and other elected officials. So this bill will move that deadline from April 1 to August 1, where it will be much more helpful for you. Judge Mahler mentioned your former colleague, Representative King Banyan, the economist at St. Cloud State right now. He is preparing and has prepared an economist report. That's helpful information for this body. You don't want to wait till April 1 to get that or for that bill, that body to have that information. Moving it up to August 1 would be much more effective. We don't think it's controversial, and we hope that it'll pass this session. The other issue is to do right now. There is currently a prohibition, and we're hoping that to remove an ex parte communication prohibition between members of the judiciary, judges, and members of the council. We need to be able to provide this information directly to the council. Right now, we have to do it through third parties. So Nancy Haas would be very helpful and very capable of bringing that information to you. But as good as she is, it's always best to have direct lines of communication. We believe that this ex parte prohibition just gets in the way. We want to be able to give you Representative or Professor Banyan's report. We want to provide the Compensation Council with additional information, of course, working with our lobbyists and other people. So those are two fixes. We don't believe they're controversial. They would improve the Compensation Council. And that's our fourth and last legislative priority this session.
And I would just mention, I visited with Representative O'Driscoll on this issue last Friday for a ride-along. I met with him, Representative Bernie Perryman, and Senator Jeff Howe. And so first of all, please come and do a ride-along with the judge. They were with me from 1 o'clock till 4:15, and we had just an excellent exchange of information. But one of the things Representative O'Driscoll said, well, when we crafted that language for the Compensation Council and the ex parte, we basically just lifted it from another state, and we're not really sure why we included it in there. So it wasn't with any type of specific legislative intent and why we thought that that was not good policy as it related to the judiciary. So I would invite this committee maybe to coordinate with him and the, I think it's the commission, I don't know his committee, but he was aware of the issue and suggested that. So I just will tell you in conclusion, I really think the citizens of Minnesota are getting good value for the justice. Many people don't know this, but there is agencies, the National Court Administration of Justice has ranked Minnesota eighth in the nation with regard to the quality of our judiciary. And we're very proud of that. You may say, well, what is that based on? And they took different factors into consideration. Access by the attorneys to our court information, access to self-represented litigants, which is probably 50% of the cases that we are dealing with now. Disability access, language access, accessibility to pay a fine online or a fee, as well as dealing with expedited consumer debt litigation. And so we feel very proud of that. And I would encourage all of you to participate in a ride-along if we can help facilitate that in any way. I know that I am 2 minutes over, Madam Chair, so I apologize.
Well, we will not chase you out of here for going 2 minutes over. So thank you for your presentation. Do we have any member questions? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding access to justice in Minnesota. So the Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced that its sensitive locations policy is no longer in effect. And under that policy, ICE did not engage in civil immigration enforcement at courthouses. And we have heard that they are, in fact, present at courthouses here in Minnesota. And I'm very concerned about the impact that that will have on the appearance of parties and witnesses. We've created visas like the U visa and the T visa that are for victims of crime to encourage them to engage with our legal systems and assist in the prosecution of those crimes. So I was just curious if you are concerned about this as well and if you're taking any steps to ensure that immigrants in Minnesota have access to justice.
Judge Mueller or Mr. Kyle, if you want to take that.
Well, I'm a member of Judicial Council, and I can tell you that I know state court administration is addressing this very seriously. I believe that they had a meeting set up with members of the federal government and ICE, and that the federal portion had to cancel because of internal issues that they are dealing with. And so we have extended the invitation to please meet with us again. To me, this is a state court administration office issue, but certainly it's one that the judges share and are concerned about disrupting the court proceedings. But I can tell you, I believe that Jeff Shorba and Chief Natalie Hudson might be best to address that. I do note that they are actively addressing it based upon my attendance last Thursday.
Madam Chair, may I just, and I could tell you, Representative, 4 years ago, I had a litigant who I had just sentenced on a misdemeanor, was not in custody, and was grabbed, apprehended by ICE agents in my courtroom. I didn't realize it. I didn't know they were there. I didn't realize it, and the gentleman was taken away. That obviously is very problematic. It caused confusion, and it caused quite a stir in the hallway later on that morning. So we're aware of this. I think the court has to balance. For all the concerns you have, we have the same similar concerns. At the same time, you know, the federal government has to. They have their priorities, and they have immigration laws to enforce. So we hope that they'll work with us. They did 4 years ago, and we were able to get some at least guidelines that you can't pick up anyone in the courtroom. You have to notify security when you're coming through, so we knew you were there. And I'm hoping that they'll show the same courtesy 4 years later. We'll find out. We'll see.
Representative Feist, you're good? All right, perfect. Did you have a question, Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to take advantage of this opportunity to get perspective from judges on our judge selection process. So in the Constitution, we have a provision for the election of judges. It's kind of become just an assumption that judges are appointed by the governor. And it's gotten to the point, I believe, where virtually every judge who's sitting on a bench somewhere has been appointed rather than elected. Now, technically, do we have judicial elections? Yes, of course. You go to the ballot, you flip it over, you see a list of names. Very uncommon, however, to see any sort of contested elections. And so there has been discussion over the years about trying to do something to address that, to kind of restore what presumably was the original intent of the framers of the state constitution, to have more competitive judicial elections. I'd be interested in getting your feedback on if that's a good idea, if it's not, and what types of reforms, if any, might be worth pursuing.
Judge Kyle or Judge Mahler?
Well, we do have a elections committee, and we work with the Board of Judicial Conduct with regard to ensuring compliance. I will tell you, I said I was a Governor Pawlenty appointee. I felt like it was very onerous for me to have to go through this process, and very few people in public know what a judge has to go through to get appointed. So first you have to fill out about a 25-page application and get about 20 letters of recommendation. Half of those letter recommendations are supposed to be from opposing counsel. So if you're a jerk, you're not going to be able to get opposing counsel to write you a decent letter. And what is the goal is we want people who are knowledgeable, experienced, and who have appropriate judicial demeanor. I tell people in this era of now we have remote hearings, it's a rare occasion where I am not told to F off every week. It happened just yesterday when I was in court. So the nature of our work has drastically changed. So when you are having to go through that process, all of that information then gets sent to a commission. And the commission is a broad, different ranging group of people. You have Republicans, you have Democrats, you have different representatives, and these are all people who volunteer. I joke because Representative Perryman was on the council when I applied, and I told her, I couldn't find anything on you on the internet except that you were an executive at Budweiser, so I was going to wear a big Budweiser t-shirt to my interview, and we joke about that. But when you have to find those letters of recommendations, and then you have that commission narrow the paper applications to interviews, and this is very reminiscent of the interview I had. You're sitting in front of this group of people, half are lawyers, half are non-lawyers, and they ask you very pointed questions, and you go through that interview, and then you have to do FBI and CIA background checks, and I think it's a very strong vetted process. I had to release records from when I went to college, everything. And then that commission makes a recommendation, usually three candidates for a judicial opening, or if there's two openings, they might send five to the governor. And then ultimately, it's the governor's decision. And so that, I think, is a better process than having people walk in parades and hand out posters. Our judicial code prevents us from giving away anything when we're running for an election. And so we have candidates, and we did have an open election up in Duluth, St. Louis County, Judge Dale Harris. He's our treasurer. He retired, prior military, so thank you for the members that are vets. I have got vet cord in my blood. But he let his seat go open. So we do have open seats that do happen. But I think the majority of the judges feel like it's a better vetting process across party lines, and then you have to still keep your seat within 2 years. You have to run to keep your seat. So I actually believe it is a good process.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that very comprehensive response. And if you have anything to say, I'd appreciate that as well.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I just add, I agree with what Judge Mahler just said, and even though most judges are appointed and most judges run unopposed every 6 years, there were two judges, we have 29 in Ramsey County, two won by in open seats in a contested election. Another judge challenged a sitting judge and beat him. And so there are instances in districts all around the state where there are contested elections, and at least at the initial appointment or even in subsequent years. But the vetting process is, you know, Judge Mahler was appointed by Governor Plenty. I was appointed by Governor Dayton. It's a nonpartisan commission. We do feel that they really look at it. It's a merit selection commission established by the legislature, and I think it works, and I would encourage the to continue to use it. It gets us good people, but occasionally there are elections, and we get good people that get challenged, and the open elections in my district, both excellent judges who ran in open seats.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for adding that as well. Thank you both for answering that question.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to the testifiers. And I'll just add to that vetting, as a practicing attorney, I've gotten a few calls because I've been opposing counsel, and that opposing counsel is applying to be on the bench. And so I'm not even on their letter of like recommendation. I didn't write letters, but they're just sort of calling the opposing counsel for their input as well. So it really is a very stringent process. I do have a couple of questions about the salary request. And, you know, I think it's hard for us when we see the amount that judges make, and it's not a reflection of that we don't think your work is valuable. I think we have an excellent bench, but we're also public, members, elected public officials, and we make about a quarter of that. And so I think, you know, when we see the requests that are asked for, sometimes they do seem a bit excessive, I will say. And I guess I'm just curious what the average age of the judges are on the bench.
Ms. Mahler.
Well, I'd like to say it's 58, which is my age, but I'm probably an older judge. I do think we've seen a very unique change in appointments. I think, and the other attorneys here can agree or give their perspective, but I think most judges would be appointed to the bench when they were about 50, 52, and then they would be done about 65, 67. So it was usually kind of a 15-year stint, and then that was kind of the pinnacle of their career. We now have more and more prosecutors and public defenders in the public sector who are applying to be judges, and they're significantly younger. So I think a change in the dynamic of who the governor was and who's applying has drastically changed in the last 15 years that I've been on the bench. I would make the observation that I am in a district where we have about 30 judges, and my district runs from roughly Mille Lacs up the I-94 corridor to Moorhead. And of those 30 judges, there's three of us who have any civil experience. And you can't attract people with civil experience to the bench because they can make so much more money in the private sector. And so when we want to talk about diversity, we also want diversity in practice areas, because if people don't know how to try a medical malpractice jury trial, who's going to do that? And so that's very problematic. You might remember Justice Eric Magnuson got on the bench. He was appointed, I believe, by Plenty as the Chief Justice, and he stayed on as the Chief Justice for only 2 years. And he who wouldn't want to be the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, right? He left because of the salary, and he had a special needs child and needed flexibility. So as judges, we have to be where we are at when we are told 8 o'clock in the morning, and you may say, "We welcome to our world," but some of you have jobs outside of this job, and so you might have the luxury of being a business owner and being able to say, "I have to schedule my work hours around my children," or what have you. We don't have that luxury. And I would also add, regarding judicial safety, I am told by national resources that judges are the number one targeted profession for an attack. I'm not saying law enforcement doesn't deal with dangerous situations every day, but they're trained and they've got Kevlar vests, and we don't have that. When I had a threat to my life, the sheriff's office called me in and said, "If you hear a firecracker, run over to the mailbox, because that might stop a bullet." That's the training I received. And so it's not as an attractive profession as what it once was.
Yeah, thank you, Madam. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks. I mean, I appreciate that. But I do hope that judges that are people that are thinking about becoming judges are thinking more about what it means to be a judge and what it means to be a public servant, and less about the money aspect of it. And, you know, I certainly can understand that those security concerns, and I'm glad we've been able, with Representative Curran's help, to pass some of that legislation and continue. Again, we face many of those same issues ourselves. And then I just wanted to say, you know, we do have to be mindful of our state budget and also potential federal cuts that are coming our way and how that impacts the state. And I just ask everybody to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Lead Liebling.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for those comments, Representative Mueller. I just had some sort of not so much comments, but just questions about the graph. Kind of it's in the same area, though, talking about the salaries. And first I want to say that I think we are very fortunate to have an excellent judiciary in this state. And I really mean that. I think it's incumbent on all of us to the judiciary is under a lot of stress right now, just like every institution of government. And, you know, I think it's incumbent on all of us to protect and defend the judiciary and your independence as a branch, too. So I think that's all very important. But I just had questions about this graph that you gave us. The one in front of me is not in color. It's a little even harder to read. But I think it's a little bit the graphing part of it. And I know, you know, making a graph isn't everybody's strong suit. So it's hard to make one that is really represents data well. But this one, it gives the impression that it's something happening over time. And that's not what it's showing at all. It's a snapshot in time that puts different pieces of information that are from different years on the same graph.
Right.
But a couple questions I had about it. You've got data on here about how much lawyers are making with 10 years experience. And I just wonder where that data comes from, because while I realize it does show on the graph there's a big range, right? With the steepness of a line on here just shows that there's a huge range in that salary, right? And I know there is for lawyers, but where are you getting that data?
Judge Mueller.
I would have to go back. I know this is information we've been tracking, but part of this is some of the information that Dr. Banyan has been gathering for us, as well as State Court Administration Office, to do these comparisons. I would be happy to provide you with those resources that are not footnoted here and readily available to me. I would note, and again, I remind, when we're talking about the public service, we have judges in Anoka who left and went back to the county attorney's office to make more money. We have, I think, 7 or 8 county attorneys who make more than judges. And up in my county, Stearns County, I think there's 5 assistant attorneys who make more than judges make. And so we feel like, even though we are in the public sector, so are they. One are counties, one are state employees. And so while I do hear all of the things that you're saying, I was told through a very reliable resource a judge who was at the county attorney's office in Stearns County. They were just approved on a three-year rotation, a 5-5 and a 5% increase over the next 3 years. So that's what's happening in the public sector among counties.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And that was kind of my next question, was whether you had actual data, because I appreciate that there are anecdotes. And, you know, we've seen legislators sometimes leave here and say, I can't afford to send my child to college, and then get a job as a lobbyist, and they make plenty of money. And that happens. But I wonder if you have data on it, because that would be more important than anecdotes. So I don't expect you to have that right now, but I would appreciate it if you could provide that to us when you get the opportunity.
Go ahead, Judge.
I would be more than happy. In fact, I'm coming down next Tuesday and meeting with some senators and House reps, and I would bring that with me next Tuesday.
Okay.
Chair Liebling, you good?
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here today.
All right. I see no other member questions. We want to thank you for being here this morning and coming in on such short notice and preparing your presentation for us. And you are free to go. We are going to now hear from the Uniform Laws Commission. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to sit in a different chair, which means I'm a different person.
All right. That sounds good, Ms. Lowe. It's good to see you, Ms. Timmons, as well. Welcome to the committee. And when you are ready, go ahead with your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the tape. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Once again, my name is Kim Lowe. I am a practicing attorney here in the Twin Cities. Just appreciate that fascinating conversation we just sat through. I don't always have that much access to the judiciary because I don't go to court. But I am also here as one of Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners, and we're here in front of your committee to talk about our budget, but also give many of you an update on who we are, what we do, and what role we serve here in Minnesota. And many of you have met with me. Some of you have actually carried legislation for me. Thank you. But we want to give you an overview so you understand as we work through our budget, and you will probably see us again because we do come through this committee pretty often. So just a little overview, and I know there are lawyers here, there are people who have heard us talk about this. The Uniform Law Commission used to be called the COOSL. So if you went to law school and go, who are we talking about? We are a 125-year-old organization. It's a nonprofit that was formed 125 years ago. It is a state organization. It was founded in 1892, and all of its members come from the various states. Each state has an ability to appoint or appoints commissioners who then come and serve as Uniform Law Commissioners for as long as they are served. What the Uniform Law Commission does is we draft uniform laws. We say that a lot. You'll hear the word uniform a lot. The goal of the commission is to find areas of law where uniformity among states is valuable. And the laws that we then work on and draft, ultimately the hope is that they will go back to the states and be enacted so that there's a framework of uniform laws around the state. Our process is pretty long, basically. I spent this past weekend on a study committee or drafting committee. Generally, when someone proposes a topic to the Uniform Law Commission, we study it for a year to see if we should do anything about it. And study committees usually entail commissioners, and I'll tell you who commissioners are, stakeholders, outside professionals, people of knowledge in that area. We study for a year or two. If we decide to go to drafting, then a drafting committee is put together, once again, of commissioners and outside experts. And that drafting committee takes 2 to 3 years to put together a single act. And that act is worked on for a great amount of time so that it's very thoughtful, all gone through a process. Every year at our annual meeting, we read acts, whether they're final or in the process. We read them line by line, and they are hotly debated by the commissioners that we have. So that's our process. Here in Minnesota, We have enacted recently, as some of you know, we enacted the Uniform Commercial Code 2022 amendments. Representative Curran was my author. That was an important enactment, and the Uniform Commercial Code is one of our most important products. Any lawyer in the room learned about the Uniform Commercial Code in law school? It's what it's our bedrock, and it's one of the most important products of the Uniform Law Commission because it sets the playing field for commerce through all of our states, and it is one of our most important products. And it's also sort of what we aim for every time we work on something else. And so that is what I tell every lawyer, yeah, that's what we did. So that's what the Uniform Commercial Code is. In Minnesota, we have enacted many uniform acts. We're considered a leader in uniform acts. We have enacted 157 uniform or model acts since 1892. Nearly 100 of them are still in effect. So we have a decent amount of acts that we enact in Minnesota. We're in the top 10% of states when it comes to enactment. In Minnesota, the way our commissioners are appointed, just so you know, right now, we have three people who are appointed by the governor, attorney general, and the chief justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and then our advisor of statute sits in those seats. Currently, I hold one of those appointed seats. We have an opening. Melissa Hortman holds one of those seats, and our revisor of statutes has those other four, the other seat. The rest of our commissioners that we have a large commission. How many do we have, 11? We have 11 commissioners.
11 currently.
Many of our commissioners have served for over 20 years or sometimes 50 years. So what happens when you're a commissioner for more than 20 years, you are eligible for what's called lifetime commission, be a lifetime member. Ms. Timmons is a lifetime member. That's why our commission, if you've heard us before, has 11 members. Like, how can four become 11? It's because we have many lifetime commissioners. And what's important for us in this state is we have three former presidents of the Uniform Law Commission, three of them. We have more former presidents than most states in the country. And those former presidents really hold a lot of respect around the country, and they bring a lot of respect back to Minnesota because of those positions that they've held. Our current commissioners are pretty busy, I have to admit. I've been all over the place. We serve on a lot of leadership roles in the commission, and we also serve on many drafting committees and many study committees. We think that's valuable to the state of Minnesota because we're right there in the mix with things that are being discussed all around the country, new topics, new areas of law, exposure to the topics. And so this is what I tell myself every day after I get off, five drafting committees, is that I bring that knowledge back to Minnesota, and I help you as lawmakers with that knowledge as well. Ms. Timmons is going to talk a little bit about our budget request and how we get there.
Go ahead, Ms. Timmons. Introduce yourself.
Madam Chair. I'm Michelle Timmons, former revisor of statutes, and currently here as a Uniform Law Commissioner and life member, as Kim explained. The budget for the Uniform Law Commission is probably the smallest budget you will look at in this committee, and it's probably the simplest. There are literally two cost centers. One is the state dues that Minnesota pays to help support the work of the Uniform Law Commission generally. That will be $73,620 this year, $77,300 in the second year of the biennium. And those dues, by the way, differ from state to state, and they're based on the population of the state. So, for example, New York and California pay way more dues than we do. We pay about the same as Wisconsin, and then North and South Dakota are going to pay significantly less. The remainder of the money goes for travel costs for the annual meeting. Uniform Law Commissioners do not get paid for their time. We're all volunteers. The only thing we do get is reimbursement for the travel costs because the annual meeting is usually 6 or 7 days. It's more like a legislative session where, as Ms. Lowe explained, we literally read the acts and debate them and come up with final language that next goes to the Bar Association for their input, and then off to the states. So for the upcoming year, we are asking for a same-level, upcoming biennium, we're asking for a same-level budget, same as currently $115,000 per year, $230,000 per biennium. So how can we do that when the dues are going up and we all know travel costs are going up as well? Well, part of the issue is that when the budget was originally put together with Commissioner Bob Tennyson did that with Minnesota Management and Budget, we did have 12 uniform law commissioners. However, Commissioner Tennyson knew to budget for only 11 because Commissioner Mike Sullivan, who some of you may have known, let Bob Tennyson know that he would be unable to travel in the upcoming biennium. And in fact, Commissioner Sullivan did pass away later last year. And he was a wonderful person, Mike Sullivan, former CEO of Dairy Queen, so really, you know, gave a lot to the state of Minnesota, and it's his passing is a huge loss for his family, of course, the Minnesota commissioners, all of Minnesota, and the Uniform Law Commission. He actually served as a past president. He's one of the three Minnesotans. So we are very sorry to have lost Mike, but the net result from a budget standpoint is that we now have 11 Uniform Law Commissioner spots to budget for travel costs instead of 12. I just want to say a little bit more about the appointments. When there's a vacancy for one of the three persons to be appointed, then that is an opening and someone will be appointed to fill that vacancy. If one of those appointed persons becomes a life member, that also creates a vacancy among those three positions. And with the revisor of statutes, it's simply when I retired, Paul Marinac became the next revisor appointment, and then when Paul retired, Brian Inman became the Uniform Law Commissioner. But when one of us passes away as a life member, that does not create an additional appointment. That simply contracts the delegation from Minnesota. And so, from a fiscal standpoint, that elimination of one position for which to budget for travel costs allows us to absorb the increases in the dues and still pay for the travel costs for the remaining commissioners. So that's how we get to a level budget request. And we think that will allow us to continue to volunteer and serve as uniform law commissioners.
Thank you, Ms. Timmons, and thank you, Ms. Lowe, for your presentation. Lead Liebling, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I'm just curious about your budget. You don't have anybody that you pay a salary to at all, and it appears, right, from what you've just described. And I'm just wondering, like, how do you do your sort of fiscal control piece? Do you do that within the commission? Like, who decides to reimburse and writes the check for the reimbursement and, you know, all that nitty-gritty kind of stuff?
Ms. Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So all of us serve as volunteers, as you heard earlier. I'm in private practice. So none of us get paid for the hours that we spend doing it. I average about 500 hours a year on ULC activities. When we attend an annual meeting and we submit for reimbursement for those expenses, we use the same guidelines that any state employee would use. So we fill out the same paperwork, the per diem, the travel cost. We live under the same regime as any state employee would when it comes to reimbursement for those costs. So when we do our budget, we just do search for the lowest cost flight. We get reimbursed for the cost of the hotel at the rack rate that we pay like any other conference.
Ms. Timmons, you want to add to that?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. I Liebling. I just wanted to add that Minnesota Management and Budget reviews all the travel claims from the Uniform Law Commissioners and applies all the state rules. So, you know, the maximum for a hotel in Chicago is, you know, what we can get reimbursed. For example, we get the per diem for the meals, that sort of thing. So it's Minnesota Management and Budget that really does the fiscal control for us.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I mean, I'm just kind of wondering how it works when you have nobody who's kind of, you know, paid to be your director or something like that for your organization. So do you just, and by the way, thank you for all your volunteer hours. I mean, that's really admirable, and thank you. And, you know, just we were just talking about, you know, public service. It's really public service. You know, we certainly don't expect people to completely volunteer their time when they're professionals, and it's just wonderful that the commission does this. And so I'm just trying to understand how the fiscal piece of it just works. And so, you know, who do you give your receipts to that reimburses you? Is that MMB that does that for you?
Correct.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Thank you for those questions, and thank you for your volunteer hours. 500 hours is, that's a crazy amount of hours to volunteer. So thank you all for doing that. And it is amazing that you have no administrator, nobody to, like, you have meetings and you're redrafting legislation. Somebody's got to put that all together. Somebody on your commission is volunteering to do all that. So we're very appreciative. Any other member questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for being here. And with that, we are adjourned.